on Iran Sat or Bat 5 and Intel Sat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
From our imams, the ninth imam is the first, whose imamat began at a very young age, about 8 or 9.
As-salamu alayka ya Abu Ja'far, Muhammad ibn Ali, al-Barakat.
Peace be upon you, O Abu Ja'far, Muhammad, the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I'm your host Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam was the ninth divinely appointed imam from among the household of the Messenger of Allah. And Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam was also the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, the Messenger of Allah. Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam lived under the wing of his father, the eighth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Ridha alayhi salam, for a relatively short period that was not more than 7 years. However, at this young and tender age, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam displayed intelligence and talents that truly astonished the minds of great thinkers. And like his father, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam had been impressed with the greatest of virtues and the highest of morals, the most profound of knowledge and wisdom, and his eternal values became as torches of guidance and awakening in the whole of the Islamic society.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear listeners, we are talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, the ninth divinely appointed imam. We find in some of the conversations of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam that he speaks about ethical and moral virtues and values. Now, of course, in the religion of Islam, ethics and morality, righteousness is one of the main pillars, if not the main pillar of the religion. The Holy Quran also has many verses which speak about these ethical and moral virtues and the divine aspect of these ethical and moral virtues. In one such conversation, we find that Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam was speaking with one of his companions. And as they were speaking about witnessing things or being absent and who is considered to be responsible in certain situations and conditions, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam says to his companion that one who witnesses something and denies it is like one who is absent from that action or deed. And on the other hand, one who is absent from something but accepts it is like the one who witnesses it. So here I think it's a little bit important to kind of explain this a little bit further. Now it's mentioned in prophetic traditions that to everyone is that which they intend. So based upon this idea, of what an individual's intention is. So if someone witnesses something but they deny it, or they denying here most probably means not being complacent with that action, not being in agreement with that action, and of course not being satisfied or content with that action that you witnessed, then you will be free from the sin of that action that was being committed, and you will be considered to be absent from it. So this was the first part of the tradition that we find in this conversation, which was that he who witnesses something but is does not accept it, does not agree to it, denies it, is like one who is absent from it, right? So for example, if we see oppression that is happening, or something, somebody is doing something bad, and we make it known that we are not in agreement with what is being done, and that we are not, complacent or satisfied or happy or in agreement to this oppression that is happening or this bad thing that is happening in front of us, and we deny this act, we reject this act, we condemn this act, which in reality is alluding to Nahi Anil Munkar, which is the prohibition of evil, then it is like you are absent from that action. But the next part is also of concern, and that is that if someone is absent from something but accept it, its good or evil will be, recorded for that individual. Now, you might be thinking, well, how is that possible? Again, as Imam al-Jawad said in the conversation, that one who is absent from something but accept it is like the one who witnesses it, and therefore they are responsible for it because they have witnessed it. So, for example, you're not present where the physical oppression is taking place. So, across many of the Muslim lands, for example, Palestine or Syria or Iraq or Yemen, we see that, or we don't, directly see, but we know that oppression is taking place. And so physically we are absent in this situation. But we are, we accept it, we're okay with it, we're not in opposition to it. We are satisfied, content, no problem. Or even, if we are complacent, or we are, we don't have a position, we are, I guess neutral is not a correct word, but we are disassociated from this, whatever is happening. In that kind of a situation, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam says, it is like you are actually witnessing it, because you're accepting it, because you're complacent with that situation, because you have not opposed that evil status quo. And if you witness it, then of course you are responsible for that situation. So, dear brothers and sisters, don't be complacent in these kind of situations. When you see something bad happening, then you should condemn it because it is bad. Of course, according to the, rules that the true jurisprudential experts have put forth for us. And on the other hand, if you see something good, go ahead and promote it, and go ahead and spread it, and make it more prevalent in society. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Thank you.
And now we invite you to listen to Shaykh Winay Keita about Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam.
Imam al-Jawad salawatullahi wa salamuhu alayhi is an interesting case study for many, many different subjects. Ibn Shahrashub in his Manaqib tells us, these are very important ulama of the earliest period, who narrate the ahadith of A'imma. Kana shadid al-udma fashakka fihi al-murtabun. He says that because of the dark complexion of the boy, fashakka fihi al-murtabun, the hypocrites, al-murtabun are people who turn away from the religion. So they started using this as shak. So color became their excuse for doubting in the imamate of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. So just so you know, this is Ibn Shahrashub narrating in the traditions in his manaqib. So it gets worse, unfortunately. So then, now these may not have been his uncles. This may have just been the outer circle or the people around the imam. So then they ordered a group of people to come to Mecca during Hajj to examine the body of the father and the son. This is known as physiognomy, ilmul firasa, where they come and they look at this body, they look at these facial features, and they didn't have DNA testing in those days, right? So they would come and see, okay, I think he's descendant of this person. No, he's not, doesn't belong to this. Of course, from Sharia perspective, this is not a dalil, of course. But they brought the imam and his son in the presence of Ma'mun during Hajj. Imam al-Jawad was 25 months old, according to the ahadith. 25 months old at the time. And they come to the imam, and they examine him. And look what happens now. فَلَمَّا نَظَرُوا إِلَيْهِ خَرُّوا لِوُجُوهِهِمْ سُجُدًا. And when they saw him, these examiners fell onto their face in sajda. They fell into sajda and they said, Ya wayhakum amithla hadhal kawkib ad-durri wa nur adh-dhahir. Woe upon you, meaning the people that called them here to Mecca. Is there something akin to this glittering star and the blazing light? Ma huwa illa min dhurriyyat an-nabi wa amir al-mu'minin. That he cannot be anything but from the progeny of the Prophet and Amir al-Mu'mineen. وَهُوَ فِي ذَلِكَ الْوَقْتِ إِبْنَ خَمْسَةٍ وَعَشْرِينَ شَهْرًا. And at that time, he was 25 months of age.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many other great programs as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Foreign ministers of Iran, Russia, Syria and Turkey agreed to prepare a roadmap for developing relations between Damascus and Ankara. Relations between Ankara and Damascus soured after the foreign-backed militancy broke out in Syria in 2011, when flows of Syrian refugees flooded Turkey. The safe and dignified return of Syrian refugees was one of the key principles for the Moscow talks.
It has been a key principle for all the countries present here to contribute to a safe and voluntary return of refugees and internally displaced persons to the places of their permanent residence in Syria, as well as to ensure their right to receive support. It appears important to start discussing the issue of restoring disrupted transport and logistics ties between neighboring countries and resuming trade and economic cooperation without any barriers.
The participants also discussed the U.S. measures in creating a so-called Free Syrian Army, which used ISIS militants and other terrorist organizations against Syria's legitimate authorities with the aim of destabilizing the situation in the country. Russian and Syrian militaries have recently discussed the issue, agreeing on a model of joint action in that regard. The sides also discussed illegitimate unilateral sanctions applied by the U.S. and its Western allies, which block the provision of international humanitarian assistance to Syria, including through the UN. The head of the Russian Foreign Ministry drew attention to the fact that the UN humanitarian plan for the current year for Syria was funded by 8%, but the emergency appeal of the same UN to provide assistance in the territories not controlled by Damascus was immediately paid almost in full.
The talks in Moscow can be called historic. Iran and Russia paved the way for the negotiation process in Syria and made great efforts to ensure that this meeting took place. Moscow has demonstrated that its conditions are realistic. It was supported by Iran in this, which has done a lot to save the sovereignty of Syria. The meeting of the Syrian minister and his Turkish counterpart gives hope for the establishment of calm in the country. Turkey had to come to terms with the fact that Bashar al-Assad's power will remain. We have witnessed a reset in relations and what the collective West has been trying to prevent in every possible way.
The process of normalizing relations between Ankara and Damascus was launched on December 28, 2022 in Moscow, when first consultations were held between the heads of the defense ministries of Russia, Syria and Turkey. Earlier, President Erdogan invited President Putin to hold a trilateral meeting with the participation of the Syrian leader. This summit, according to him, should have been preceded by negotiations at the level of representatives of the special services, defense and foreign ministers.
The foreign ministers of Iran, Russia, Turkey and Syria warned that their countries will not allow any external interference in regional affairs. They expressed readiness to boost their fight against terrorism, saying they will be in full swing to ensure security. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
EU leaders are accused of failing the people of Sudan. The 27-nation bloc's weak foreign policy in Africa has allowed tensions to develop into chaos and carnage, according to some legislators in the European Parliament.
We must understand that hoping for the best is not sufficient. If we do not engage constructively and in a timely, effective manner, we will always need to run for cover when it is already too late.
It's the Rapid Support Forces versus the Sudanese Armed Forces. Rival generals, once allies, are battling it out.
The West were happy to legitimize a de facto military dictatorship because this is the arrangement that has served our financial interests and the interests of the IMF and the World Bank for many years.
In the Sudanese capital, Khartoum, hundreds of people have been killed and thousands injured. The situation in Darfur and other regions is also dire. When it comes to African nations, the West is accused by critics of only ever having been interested in pillaging natural resources, such as gold, diamonds and oil. At least 450,000 people have been forced to flee their homes in Sudan since war broke out on April 15th.
Let us not allow for a new tragedy, or at least do the utmost of our efforts. If the EU wants to live up to its values, this is the time to go for our limits.
Foreign powers are competing for influence in Sudan because of its position on the map. Apparently, the EU has taken its eye off the ball.
Don't make the mistake to only focus on the war in Ukraine. All kinds of leaders seize the opportunity because they see the European Union as a soft power entity.
The EU has opened its doors to millions of Ukrainian refugees. The bloc is being criticized for not providing safe routes for those escaping Sudan.
I hope that this will be a matter for the meeting of the Foreign Affairs Council, which takes place this weekend. It's currently not on the agenda. And I would urge the Commission to try to address this.
Some commentators claim Washington is pouncing on the crisis with an aim of implementing ideological changes by removing Islam from Sudan's constitution. Once again, the US is accused of interference to try and further its own agenda. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The ex-Pakistani Prime Minister was detained on Tuesday afternoon while leaving the Islamabad High Court premises in a stunning turn of events. Khan was arrested by a team of the country's anti-corruption body that was assisted by a large contingent of paramilitary troops when he was making his attendance in two cases related to sedition and attempted murder. Khan's graft case is one of over 100 cases registered against him since he was ousted from power in a parliamentary vote in April last year. The former PM has been accusing the government as well as the top military officials of involvement in assassination plot against him, which was denied by both. Just hours before his arrest, Khan said in his last video message that he will prefer to die rather than accept slavery.
I might have been arrested in a false case when this message reaches all of you. The fundamental rights and democracy have been vanished from the country. Whatever happening at the moment is because of this imported government. So it's time for all of you to take to the streets for real freedom of the country.
The government says that Khan's arrest was made in accordance with the law as he was involved in corruption of 119 million British pounds.
Mr. Khan was doing corruption along with his family and friends when he was the Prime Minister. The embezzled money was deposited in a trust which was registered under Imran Khan and his wife's name. The money should have been deposited in the National Treasury, but went into a property which was registered under a trust.
Following the arrest, thousands of Khan's supporters took to the streets across Pakistan to protest their leader's detention. Clashes between police and protesters were also reported in all major cities and towns of the country.
The arrest of the former Pakistani Prime Minister has further fueled the political standoff between the government and the opposition. Experts believe the country's political atmosphere would be more charged and violent in days to come. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
On May 9th, Russia commemorates the capitulation of Nazi Germany to the Soviet Union and the 27 million Soviet soldiers and civilians killed in the World War II, known in Russia as the Great Patriotic War. This year, the victory parade on Red Square in the heart of Russian capital Moscow was held without the usual aerial maneuvers and with a minimum of equipment. With the latest military developments in the Ukraine war, fighter jets, tanks and missile defense systems were partly showed, as they are needed today at the front line. In his Victory Day speech, President Vladimir Putin said that the real war is once again unleashed against Russia, but the country will ensure its security and protect the inhabitants of Donbas.
Boundless ambition, arrogance and impunity inevitably lead to tragedies. This is the reason for the catastrophe the Ukrainian people are going through. They have become hostage to the coup d'etat and the resulting criminal regime of its Western masters, collateral damage in the implementation of the cruel and self-serving plans.
Vladimir Putin also criticized the demolition of monuments to Soviet soldiers and said the West is creating a Nazi cult. The president pointed out that the desecration of a generation of victors is a crime.
It is a crime, an outright revanchism on the part of those who were cynically and blatantly preparing a new march on Russia and who brought together neo-Nazis come from around the world for this. Their goal, and there is nothing new about it, is to break apart and destroy our country, to make null and void the outcomes of World War II, to completely break down the system of global security and international law, to choke off any sovereign centers of development.
и международного права.
At 14, I became a partisan, then an infantryman, machine gunner. This is our victory, and we have won this memory. We see the depressing example of Europe. I want to say that Russians will never forget this day and will always remember it. Here, it will always be honored.
I'm from Makeyevka, from Donbas. My entire mining family has perished since 2014. Only one son remained. And today, I've come here in Moscow to pay my debt to all the defenders, the soldiers of our past and present.
Unlike last year, the Russian president did not announce new measures to support the participants in the special military operation, but noted the leaders of the CIS countries who came to celebrate Victory Day in Moscow. Together with Putin, the leaders of Armenia, Belarus, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan watched the parade on Red Square.
For millions of Russians, May the 9th is a lot more than a national celebration. Today, Russians celebrate their victory over the Nazis in 1945. The Russians are one of the last to celebrate this holiday officially, remember which sides were the heroes and at what cost the Soviets got this victory. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Israeli warplanes carried out a series of airstrikes at Pred on Tuesday, which resulted in the death of three high-profile military commanders of the Islamic Jihad movement, Tariq Izzeddin, Khalil al-Bahdini, and Jihad al-Ghanim. The Ministry of Health confirmed the death of 13 Palestinians altogether, including women and children, among them the wives and children of the Islamic Jihad commanders. 20 others were also injured, some of them in serious condition. The Israeli airstrikes, which targeted the middle of the Gaza City and Rafah and Khan Yunis in the southern of the coastal enclave, caused a great destruction of the residential apartment buildings as well.
I was asleep, and suddenly the explosion broke out and the rubble fell on us. My granddaughter was asleep by my side. We both woke up, not able to see anything from the destruction.
The Israeli occupation has a record in killing Palestinian civilians, children and women. Today, Maya Ezzeddin and Haja al-Bahdani, two Palestinian girls, the daughters of the Islamic Jihad leaders, fell victim to the Israeli attacks, like the other thousands of innocent children that were killed before.
Palestinian resistance movements have mourned the martyrs and the family members and condemned the Israeli assassination. In several statements released, they have warned the Israeli occupying regime of the scale and the scope of the Palestinian response to the crime.
The Israeli assassination of the Al-Quds Brigade's commanders is going to cost the Israeli occupation a heavy price. It is a legitimate right to fight the Israeli occupation, and it's the resistance's duty to defend the Palestinian people against any Israeli aggression. The heinous atrocity of the Israeli occupation that resulted in the assassination of three senior leaders of the Islamic Jihad movement and other civilians will see the Palestinian resistance factions unite in their crushing response as usual. We have the right to resist the Israeli occupation as it continues to commit war crimes against our people.
Thousands of Palestinians carried the bodies of the martyrs from the hospital to the Grand Al-Umari Mosque and then to the final destination to bury them in the northern Gaza Strip. Thousands of Palestinians took to the streets to express their anger over the Israeli crime that resulted in the death of innocent women and children. Palestinians are now calling for retaliation. The Palestinian resistance factions are now preparing for a crushing response to the Israeli attack and the assassination of the Islamic Jihad commanders, affirming their unity against the regime. Ulal Asi, Gaza.
The fifth international exhibition of the export capabilities of Iran is underway at Tehran International Permanent Fairground from May 7th to 10th. The event aims to help companies export their products, develop new markets, and promote their industries while focusing on the importance of non-oil exports. One of the most successful contributors to Iran's non-oil revenues is the country's free industrial and trade zones, which accounted for one-third of the country's non-oil exports last year. During a press conference, the secretary of Iran's Free Zones High Council said 370 major investment projects are going to be executed in seven free trade zones across the country, and all investors are welcome to participate in these projects.
Our colleagues have conducted preliminary studies about investment in the seven free industrial and trade zones. Preliminary justification plans have been prepared, which shows that these projects are going to be profitable. Studies related to the market, land, energy, etc. have also been conducted.
There are seven active free zones in Iran, including Kish, Chabahar, Qeshm, Anzali, Aras, Arvand, and Maku. According to official statistics, the free zones' productions were about $1 billion last year. One of the most important free zones with lots of potential is the Chabahar free zone.
Chabahar free zone is located near the Mokran coastal region. Based on the description of the Islamic Republic of Iran's leader, this region is a hidden treasure in Iran. He has mentioned this several times. As the third energy hub of the country, petrochemical units are going to be opened in Chabahar. These units will begin production after 2 years, and their products will be ready to be introduced to the global market.
Free zones have helped the process of development of Iran through providing conditions that have attracted foreign investors.
Customs and transportation services are much better in the free zones. Also, there are better investment opportunities there. Aras Free Zone is one of the seven free zones in Iran. This zone has been very successful in industrial activities as well as agriculture.
Officials say the development of projects in free zones is expected to attract a huge volume of investment valued at $5 billion to Iran's economy. The projects are also going to generate new employment opportunities for 23,000 job-seeking people at large. Iran Expo 2023 has introduced hundreds of investment opportunities in the country's trade and industrial free zones. The free zones of Iran, as one of the important tools of development, play an important role in the prosperity of the national economy. Ahdi Abbasian, Tehran.
Srinagar, which is the main city of Indian-administered Kashmir, has been given a significant facelift, something that has not happened in decades. Roads are freshly finished, sidewalks fixed, cycle tracks laid, and new colourful signboards placed. All arrangements came after New Delhi-backed administration announced that it will host G20 meeting sessions in Kashmir. Now authorities say G20 meetings have come as a blessing to Srinagar's developmental projects.
We are at a very advanced stage of most of work in many of our projects. Similarly, what we are also doing is that we have started working in the double shift. So in the night also, the work keeps on going. So with the same intention that this progress of the work should speed up. Now, G20 came as a boon to us. It's a good opportunity for us to further speed up. And I think it has helped us in overall, pushing our work on top gear and helping us better coordinate and making sure that we complete many of these projects at a much faster pace.
The projects which were in a wait list for the past 5 years have been completed in a matter of no time. The citizens have appreciated the pace of the work but are criticizing some aspects.
For the people living in Srinagar, these projects make no sense. We wanted road widening for the ease of transport in the city center. Instead, they have shrunk the roads and broadened sidewalks. The administration is yet to make its decisions clear to the citizens. They have just made parts of Srinagar as a showpiece.
Smart city.
They have dug up the entire city and we are really fed up. There is no plan for the city. The businesses have been strongly dented. We are a tourism-based economy, but tourists are not even coming this way. So what sort of smart city planning is this? This is public money and people have not been taken on board.
India is expected to host 215 meetings at some 55 locations this year. Following India's move, Pakistan has accused India of exploiting its membership in G20 to advance its quote, self-serving, unquote, agendas. However, India has called these decisions as internal matter. The meetings will be the first major international event held in Kashmir since Narendra Modi-led BJP government scrapped Kashmir's semi-autonomous special status in August 2019. The legislations divided the Muslim majority region into two federally administered territories.
The stage is all set and Srinagar is all ready to host the G20 meetings. Experts say G20 meetings in Kashmir is an opportunity for India to display the return of normalcy in the conflict-ravaged Kashmir. However, people of the region say New Delhi's good work in Kashmir must not revolve around the G20 meetings alone. It must move beyond and look for the larger good of people who have suffered for decades. Shahana Bhatt, Indian-administered Kashmir.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The widespread dissatisfaction of UK's patients and also employees working in the British National Health Service, including a significant part of doctors and nurses who are going to resign in protest of the current situation, has put this system at risk of full-scale bankruptcy more than ever. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world press and news agencies to shed more light on the issue. Please stay with us. The website of Business Telegraph writes, a report revealed more than 160 pharmacies across England have been forced to shut down over the last 2 years due to surging operational costs, staff shortages and scrapped government financial support. According to data from NHS Business Services Authority, the number of community chemists has fallen to a record low since 2015, standing at about 11,000 chemists. Without a chemist, the pharmacy is physically closed, as many rely on a local chemist for advice and to pick up prescriptions. According to the British pharmacist estimation, there has been a 30% cut in the government's financial support over the last 7 years, after taking account of inflation. Despite the rising patient demand, the pharmacies are still struggling with the obstacles, with the government incapable of handling the crisis across the sector. Meanwhile, this is not the end of a story across British health system, and the pharmacies are warning that the situation could get worse, with many more local businesses being forced to close without help. Sanjeev Panesar, a pharmacy owner in Birmingham, said the sector is crumbling and is going to fall down like a stack of dominoes if there is not intervention urgently, adding, "Things are in serious jeopardy. It's our worst year ever, where we've made a loss. We have to make some really tough calls and decisions now." Panesar called on political leaders, including Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, to urgently address the issue and relieve the pressure on pharmacies. By the way of background, a 5-year contract was agreed between NHS England and the government in 2019 to support the sector, but pharmacies say it's no match for the rise in prices. Leila Hanbeck, chief executive of the Association of Independent Multiple Pharmacies, said, "We've been left with a contract that doesn't take into account any inflation or any cost of living." She said in an interview recently, "Pharmacies are under a lot of pressure at the moment. All pharmacies are. The cost of medicines is rising. They simply do not have the funding to keep them afloat." The UK National Health Service has recently been grappling with several challenges, with tens of thousands of health staff walking out over a pay dispute with the government. Delayed discharge, bed shortages, a fresh wave of COVID-19 and flu infections, and lack of funds are among the most prominent pressures that the NHS has been facing during the last few months. Repetitive strikes by nurses, ambulance drivers, junior doctors, and other staff across the system have caused staff shortages, which has in turn put the patients' lives at serious risk. Meanwhile, the Evening Standard Daily reports nurses across the UK have waged a new strike as part of a protest action by the Royal College of Nursing RNC trade union in what they refer to as their largest work stoppage to date this year, as the cost of living crisis deepens across the country. The strike affected half of the British government's National Health Service, NHS Trust, marking the first time nurses working in A&E, accident and emergency. Intensive care and cancer services have joined the picket lines. The 28-hour strike took place ahead of a crucial meeting between a number of health unions, cabinet ministers and NHS executives recently, when the government's pay offer of 5% was discussed. The Royal College of Nursing, RCN, had earlier rejected the government's wage hike offer and declared this latest strike, which is their third so far this year, in the dispute over pay, recruitment and retention in the NHS. Members of the Unite Union at some NHS trust and ambulance services in England also took part in a strike action after voting to reject the latest pay offer. NHS England also announced that the strike was the largest industrial action so far, warning patients to expect disruptions and delays to services over the strike period. It further warned that the staffing levels for some areas would be exceptionally low, lower than on one previous strike days, and the number of rescheduled appointments as a result of a strike action was due to hit 500,000 in coming days. Meanwhile, Unite members at the Yorkshire Ambulance Service and Guy's and St. Thomas NHS Trust in central London also started a walkout and staged a protest march in central London. Then Unite members at South Central, South East Coast and West Midlands Ambulance Trust, alongside workers at the Christie NHS Foundation Trust and Pathology Partnership, East Lancashire Hospitals NHS Trust and Sandwell and West Birmingham NHS Trust, took part in this strike action. Furthermore, The Guardian Daily reports Britain's top general practitioner, GP, said patients are developing cancers and enduring so much pain that they cannot climb stairs because of 7.2 million-strong waiting list for NHS scans and treatment. Professor Camilla Hawthorne, the chair of the Royal College of GPs, said the record delays for care and uncertainty for patients about when they would finally be seen was leaving people feeling helpless and forgotten. She said these included people with heart problems, those awaiting a hip or knee replacement, and people with potential signs of cancer, whom GPs have said need to be seen urgently. In an interview with The Guardian, she voiced serious concern that some of these patients saw their health deteriorate as a direct result of the delay in accessing hospital care. She said, patients getting sicker while they are on the waiting list is something GPs see and worry about because the risk to the patient is so much greater. It's inevitable that some people stock will get sicker because that's the nature of illness. Hawthorne, who represents Britain's 50,000 family doctors, called on the NHS to set up an Amazon-style tracking system that would let patients monitor when they would be seen. In an aerial world, the NHS would have a system that would let people track where they are on the waiting list. She added, when we buy something online, we are told our order been received, when it's ready for dispatch and the date and time it's coming. Something along those lines will help patients understand where they are on the list and help GPs manage their expectations as well. A tracker system would reassure patients who are anxious, worried, and frustrated about when they will finally be seen and help them to negotiate the jungle of the NHS. In addition, it would mean they would no longer need to ask their GP to ring the hospital to find out when their appointment will happen, thus freeing up more appointments slots.
Seven barometric pressure.
We come to you, and O God, knowing that thou art our only King.
You're listening to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with Brother Yasser Ibrahim.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين. اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners. Welcome to another episode of Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. It's mentioned many times and in many different programs that Islam, and I'm sure many of us have also heard this from a very young age, that Islam is a way of life. And this way of life is not just meant to be something that, you know, influences the private life of a Muslim. It is a way of life that, yes, it does influence the private life of a Muslim, but it is also something that therefore needs to show itself in the public life of Muslims in an Islamic society, which then becomes an Islamic civilization. So the Islamic way of life is the true, and it is a main part of this Islamic civilization. Islamic civilization is where it can, you know, truly in the public sector or in the public eye, in the public domain, in the societal domain, manifest itself. And because why? Because this way of life is that which comprises the backdrop and forms the backbone of our very life. Therefore, we see that this true and main part of this Islamic civilization, which includes things like modes and styles of family. How do you, you know, establish a family? Obviously, before there comes marriage, how you build your houses, what clothes you wear, what food you consume, what things you buy, technology, entertainment, and so on and so forth, which you can do, which you cannot do, how you should go about doing it, and so on and so forth. So all of these things, all of these aspects form our way of life. And these things therefore compromise, rather, not compromise, compile the civilization that we want to kind of push for, which is an Islamic civilization. So inshallah, in the next segment of this particular episode, we'll be introducing a book that tries to deal with this issue in a very different manner. So please stay tuned.
Why do we read books in the first place? What are books good for?
We read books because we don't want to reinvent the wheel, if you will.
We'd better take advantage of human cultural and intellectual heritage, particularly related to our daily activities, such as our physical, mental, spiritual, or even religious health.
We can't ignore the past thoughts and experiences. To do so, we need to boost our bookshelf.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. So the book that we would like to introduce to our dear listeners today is titled Hadith of Life, Commentaries on Selected Hadith of Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam, of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam, by Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. The book was then compiled by Hussein Arad Mard and Hamid Mahjur. It was then translated by Brother Zaid or Sheikh Zaid As-Salami. The book was published by A'immatul Huda Publication in the city of Qom in the Islamic Republic of Iran. So this particular book deals with three aspects of human life, that is individual life, social life, and spiritual life. And it is a collection of a hadith that were mentioned by Sayyid Ali Khamenei, the current leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, dealing, you know, with these particular issues. And these particular explanations and commentaries and explanations of these traditions that obviously were from the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam were given at the beginning of his advanced classes on jurisprudence, which is known as Bahthul Kharij. And as we mentioned, it is compiled of three chapters, which is obviously individual life, social life, and spiritual life. And within them, there are five sections. For example, individual life is divided into virtues and vices. Social life is therefore divided into society, government, and family. So these are the particular aspects or the particular chapters that comprise this particular book. The book comprises of nearly 110 traditions from the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam, obviously then followed by the short explanation of these traditions that were mentioned by Sayyid Ali Khamenei in the beginning of his advanced classes on Islamic jurisprudence, which were delivered in the capital of the Islamic Republic of Iran, which is Tehran. So inshallah, we hope to mention maybe one or two of these traditions in reading the commentaries of Sayyid Ali Khamenei, hafadahullah, may Allah protect him and prolong his life, in our next segment, inshallah, for the benefit of our dear listeners. So please stay tuned.
Among the sacred texts we have received to help us understand where we came from and where we are going as a human race are most rich in helping us find our direction. They narrate stories of our past. But where have they brought us? Where are their messages now? Are we the people of belief, or have we become the people of the boxes? Is there wisdom trapped in our bookshelves? Bookshelves, bookshelves, bookshelves.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasir Ibrahim. The book that we introduced to our dear listeners was titled Hadith of Life. It is a book that comprises of the commentaries on selected hadiths of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam that were obviously expounded and, you know, explained by Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, Hafadahullah. The book was compiled by Hussein Radmar and Hamid Mahjur and translated by Sheikh Zayd al-Salami and was published in Qom in the Islamic Republic of Iran. So we'll be reading from topic 69, what does taqwa mean? So the book starts with us that it mentions the hadith, the Arabic version of it, the translation of the hadith, and then the commentary of it by Sayyid Ali Khamenei follows. So this hadith obviously has the Arabic, which for, you know, lack of time, we will not mention Arabic and go straight to the English. So Imam Sadiq alayhi salam is reported to have said, it was through piety that Noah and those with him in the ark were saved, and Salih and those with him were saved from the thunderbolt. It is through piety that the patient ones attained victory. This hadith was mentioned under the topic, what does taqwa mean? This is the continuation of a letter from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. This is the continuation of a letter Imam Sadiq alayhi salam had written to Sa'ad al-Khair, that is Sa'ad ibn Abdul Malik al-Amawi, saying that it was because of piety, taqwa, the Prophet Noah alayhi salam and his companions in the ark were saved. Prophet Salih alayhi salam and those who believed in him were also saved from the thunderous lightning because of piety. Piety means one awaits the commands and prohibitions of Almighty God and is wary of never violating them. This is what taqwa means. Suppose that when Prophet Nuh alayhi salam or Prophet Noah alayhi salam received divine revelation to build an ark on land where there was neither a house nor any water, how would he have acted if he was to be following his reason, that is his intellect? He followed his piety. He insisted on following God's command. Piety can help one pass through perishing crossings and overcoming dangerous paths, where without piety it would be impossible. Salvation and safety could not be possible without piety. Therefore, we must act according to what Almighty God has commanded. Those who were patient and tolerated all the difficulties imposed on them, and with all the enmity directed at them, they overcame it and won through piety, successfully reaching their required results. Piety is when you take care of the straight path that God has allocated for you. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to enable us to act upon the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wa sallam after understanding them properly and inculcating them in our daily life, inshallah. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Bookshelf with Brother Yasser Ibrahim on RIB English Radio.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.